It is 1:47 p.m. It's Monday, March 15, 2021. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Drummond, Representative Christ Tompkins, my vice chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is a confirmation hearing. The speaker has referred the following governor's appointment to the Judiciary Committee, Attorney General, Department of Law. Members have received the appointee's resume. The appointee is present and will testify. We will now open public testimony. Mr. Taylor, if you would like to come forward and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Representative Clayman, and to all the esteemed members of the House Judiciary Committee. It's a pleasure to appear before you this afternoon, and I appreciate all of your willingness to meet with me individually in the last several weeks. My name is Treg Taylor. I'm honored that the governor has asked me to serve as Alaska's Attorney General. I wanted to give you an overview of who I am and how I ended up in front of you today so that you better understand what makes me tick. I grew up in southern Alberta, Canada. For several years, my family lived on the First Nations Blood Indian Reservation, the largest First Nations reservation in Canada, as both my parents were school teachers at the reservation school district. We later moved to a small community next to the reservation as my parents continued to teach. While I never became conversant in the Blackfoot language because my native friends only spoke English, my little sister's first words and sentences were in Blackfoot. I have fond memories of the reservation gatherings and eating, dancing, and singing at the powwows. I learned a deep respect for their culture and traditions. I was even given the Indian name of Dirty Moccasin because of my habit of running around covered in dirt. I have always been drawn to public service, and growing up, my dreams was always to fly fighters for the U.S. Air Force. I know, a strange dream for a Canadian boy, but my hero and my role model was my grandfather, who had flown bombers for the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II.
Mr. Taylor, if you could just pause for a minute while I recognize that Representative Vance and Representative Kirker have also joined us. Okay. Please continue. Yep.
Coincidentally, he was stationed twice in Anchorage after the war, once doing cold weather testing in the B-29s, and once in his later work as an attorney for the U.S. State Department. My father was a boy when my grandpa was stationed in Alaska, and he has vivid memories of selling newspapers along 4th Avenue and looking for fossils on Government Hill. From my grandfather, I knew that to live my dream, I would need stellar grades and excellence in my extracurricular activities. I went to work. That dream kept me out of a lot of trouble growing up. After my parents divorced, I moved to Iowa with my mom during my middle school years and first years of high school. I finished high school in Utah and applied and was accepted to the United States Air Force Academy. I was ecstatic. I was so close to living out my dreams. My first year was predictably difficult, although looking back, some of my fondest memories occurred during that year. Near the end of the academic year, my class was finally recognized, meaning that we were finally treated as equals who belonged at the Air Force Academy. The second year was largely thought to be the toughest academically. That's because you start your core required classes. The Academy allows cadets after their second year to serve religious missions. I opted to serve a mission for my church along with 28 other cadets. I was assigned to labor and serve in the Canary Islands, which are two provinces of Spain, about 40 miles off the coast of Morocco. Like my time in the First Nations Blood Indian Reservation, during those 2 years on the islands, I learned to love a people and a culture different than my own. I also found great joy in serving others. Near the end of my mission, I reapplied to the academy and was accepted back. They sent me a one-page document that I needed to sign and send to accept my reappointment. I went to sign it and couldn't. For 2 weeks, I tried to sign that document. I wanted so badly to return to the academy. I absolutely loved my time there, and I was so close to living my dream of flying fighters. It was a hard 2 weeks. I felt guilty because here I was serving a mission and supposed to be serving the people of the Canary Islands, yet all I could think about was this decision. I couldn't sleep. I was miserable. One morning, exhausted, I fell to my knees and frustratedly declared to God, "Fine, I'll do what you want me to do." I didn't know why, but I knew immediately what I was supposed to do, and the academy wasn't part of that plan. Within a few weeks of returning home, I found out one very good reason why. That's when I met my wife, Jody. I was very interested in getting to know her. However, she was not at all interested in getting to know me. 22 years of marriage later, I still strive each day to convince her that she made a good choice. You'll have to ask Jody how I'm doing. We now have 6 children, 5 girls, Quincy, London, Romy, Roxy, and Callie, and a boy, Gage. Our oldest daughter is now married and attending BYU, her apartment just blocks from the hospital where she was born when Jody and I were undergrads, and our youngest is almost 9 months, crawling all around the house. After we were married, Jody and I worked several summers in Alaska to put ourselves through school, and I had fallen in love with her home state. Near the end of law school, I asked Jody where she wanted me to look for permanent work. She replied, "Anywhere but Alaska." She had lived her entire life in Alaska and wanted to experience something new. We identified a few cities we would like to live, and I earnestly began looking for work. However, a few months later, nothing seemed to be working out. We decided we need to expand our search to additional cities and made it a matter of prayer. A few days later, I came home and she announced that she knew where we were supposed to look. She explained that the whole day she couldn't keep a certain song out of her head. Then she sang, "8 stars of gold on a field of blue, Alaska's flag, may it mean to you." I couldn't have been happier. As it was, we were already returning to Alaska 2 weeks later to attend her sister's wedding. At the reception, I met a gentleman who indicated that he worked with a firm that he thought might be hiring. I reached out to the firm the next day. They informed me that they hadn't yet advertised the position, but they would like to interview. Within 2 hours, I was sitting in the interview. They offered me a position on the spot. Jody and Quincy stayed in Alaska while I returned for finals and then drove up the Alcan in our Hyundai Elantra that luckily fit everything that Jody and I owned. At DeLisa, Moran, Garrity, and Zobel, I primarily worked with Mike Garrity, who eventually became the state's attorney general. My practice largely consisted of business litigation defense. During my time there, we represented the state, the municipality of Anchorage, energy companies, and many other Alaskan businesses. After about 5 years at DeLisio, I received a call from McKinley Capital Management to see if I was interested in coming to work in-house. That idea appealed to me as I played team sports through college, and I wanted to work more in a team atmosphere with a common goal of strengthening and growing a company. I always felt like I was a hired gun during my time at the litigation firm. During my time at McKinley, we entered the Great Recession, and one of my primary responsibilities was to help the company navigate the rapidly changing investment management regulatory schemes throughout the world. I next accepted a position at Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Energy Services Division, where I acted as in-house counsel for about 8 oil and gas service companies. During that time, the price of oil plunged, and I helped these companies through that very difficult time. After about 5 years at ASRC, the governor asked me if I was willing to serve as the deputy attorney general over the civil division. I have now been at the attorney general's office for a little over 2 years. My wife and I have made it a priority to be involved in and serve in the community. We have had many wonderful experiences as a family doing so, and as we have served, we have become keenly aware of some of the issues facing Alaskan families. Highlights of what I learned include the following. Jody and I helped bring Living Legends, a Native American, Polynesian, and Hispanic origin dance group, to the Performing Arts Center and provided a free concert for local school children, including students from the Alaska Native Charter School and the Alaska Military Youth Academy. The director of the academy later told us that the event was so powerful for the minority cadets and that some of them had expressed to him that it was the first time they felt proud of their minority heritage. That was a revelation for Jody and me, and it is one area that I intend to address at every opportunity. Another example of what I learned is after realizing that our oldest daughter, that the ACT prep class due to cost were outside the realm of many Alaskan families, we helped organize a free multi-day ACT prep camp with an emphasis on inviting minority students, including Alaska Natives. It's amazing what an extra few points on an SAT can do for opportunities and for scholarships. What I learned was that businesses, community organization, and individuals are ready and willing to help in an effort to fill this and other needs in our community. For example, when an Alaskan business was asked to serve or provide the one day's lunches, they replied no. They wanted to donate all of the needed lunches. Another time, we helped organize a food drive that ended in a community event at Shiloh Baptist Church. One booth we helped with told the survivor stories of many Alaskans who have been sexually assaulted and abused, some of whom expressed that that was the first time they felt heard and validated. From this experience, I learned the importance of being heard in the healing process for survivors of sex crimes. Finally, my wife and I also helped organize and participate in a group made up of LGBT community leaders and religious leaders from various denominations to address several issues. For well over a year, we met regularly to work on these issues. I learned from this experience that individuals from very different backgrounds and sometimes preconceived notions can work together for a common good, but that it takes time and effort, and mostly it takes listening. At the end of January, when the governor asked if I'd be willing to serve as the state's next attorney general, my first thoughts turned to Alaska's ignominious ranking as the worst state for sex crimes. I think many of you have seen this slide that's presented often by our criminal division, but that it shows that Alaska has the highest rate of sex crimes. Our rate is almost double that of the next state, which is Arkansas. I see this slide every day in my mind. I am determined to do everything within my power to address this epidemic in our state. If I don't use the full authority of this office to seek out and find justice for victims of sex crimes, then I will fail my duty and failed the people of this great state. I truly believe that until this scourge is rooted out and our mothers, wives, sisters, and children feel protected and safe, we are hobbled as a state. I am under no illusion that this is an easy problem to address, and I know that many efforts have been made in the past and are ongoing, but I know that I must try. If my attempts fail, I will keep going back to the drawing board and try again. Jody constantly reminds our children to lift where they stand, and they can make the world a better place. I promise you that as the Attorney General, I will lift where I stand and make Alaska a better place for every Alaskan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. I know we had spoken with folks from your office. If you wanted to ask any particular folks as invited testimony to come forward today, I don't see anybody in the queue as invited testimony, so we'll move on to before we go to public testimony, at least we'll start with questions from the committee. It's the practice in this committee. You've never appeared before us before, but people can ask more than one question, but it's 1 minute per question, so I'll see if there's members of the committee with questions. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, welcome. It's good to see you again. In our meeting, Mr. Taylor, I really appreciated your openness with respect to some very difficult and serious issues, and that some of these issues that you would, and I appreciate that you addressed some of those same issues in your testimony just now. And I hope that we can pick up that conversation just a little bit where we left off, because we only had a short time. I would love to hear some additional thoughts of yours. So, we did talk about the circumstances around Ed Sniffen's resignation, and it was nice to hear you express the sentiment that you were disappointed that there were so many opportunities for adults who knew better that could stop it, but they didn't. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you remember that part of our conversation, Mr. Taylor?
I do.
Thank you. And following a similar thread, and we did not have the opportunity to talk about this in particular, which is why I wanted to ask you today. Former Attorney General Clarkson's misconduct occurred months before it was brought to the public, and I wanted to ask you, were you aware of his behavior, and specifically I'm referring to the series of inappropriate text messages?
No, I was not.
When did you become aware?
I became aware after he had already been placed on unpaid administrative leave.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vance and then Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming before us and
you know, telling us a little bit about how you got here, and also what you see as part of your responsibility to address one of our greatest epidemics. That is definitely on my heart. And along with the questions of Rep. Snyder, you know, I think we should just, you know, hit this head on because it's on so many people's minds. One of the things that I continue to hear from your testimony just now is what you've learned over different experiences and situations in your life. And so my question is, over the accusations that have come from the previous attorneys general, what have you learned about how to address that as our attorney general, and how will you change that for the future?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, that's a great question, and I'll try to address that. I think what I've learned through those experiences as it deals with specifically sexual assault and domestic violence in our state, I personally have three close family members that have experienced that in their lives, and the thing that they have all in common is that the perpetrator has never been brought to justice, all three of them. And when we look at these problems in our society, it's obviously a multifaceted issue, right? There's certain things that we can do within the Department of Law. We're trying to take those steps. Some of those steps include we're doing training in sex assault prosecution every year. We have a new position that we're filling with a person to provide that training. I'm hoping that we can extend that training to law enforcement as well in the future. We have two additional attorneys, prosecutors that are being paid for by the federal government that primarily are responsible for, that are being utilized in rural areas. And then this budget cycle, we're asking for an additional funding for 10 new prosecutors and 9 support staff to primarily work on sexual crimes in the state. And but that's just what law can do, right? There's so many things, other things that need to change. I'm currently reading a book. It's called The Way of the Human Being by a gentleman with the last, I can't remember the first name, I apologize, but Napoleon. And he describes how devastating the various epidemics from 1770 through 1940 have been on the Alaska Native population, how those epidemics ripped through the Native settlements. And his hypothesis is sort of that they have PTSD from that experience and that they've never fully recovered. And just looking at from the different perspectives, that's a new perspective for me that I hadn't had. And so I intend to, as you said, to reach out. I'm hoping that through reaching out and better understanding the issues, they'll have a better idea of what we as the Department of Law can do to address that serious issue that we have in our state.
A follow-up?
Representative Vance.
Thank you for that. I think it's helpful that our AG be able to have a different perspective. What type of internal policy are you going to set within your office for accountability and transparency for how you conduct yourself as our Attorney General and regard to other members that you work with?
Yeah, that's through the chair. That's, yeah, I hold myself to the highest standards, and I sometimes fall short of those standards, but it's a daily fight that I take on every day, and with every decision I make, I try to use the values that I was raised with and make the best decisions. Those aren't always the best decisions, and so I promise to keep learning, and then I also promise to hold employees of the Department of Law responsible for any of the actions that they take that is contrary to that, especially in circumstances where we're talking about harassment, creating workplaces that are unsafe or feel unsafe to the individual. Certainly, there's a between transparency to the public and protecting the victims in those cases, and the issues with personnel files. Obviously, we're not always going to be able to make that public, but I do promise to take those issues very seriously and have taken those issues very seriously throughout my career. I've had opportunities to address some of those issues in the various capacities that I've served, especially as in-house counsel, and we've always taken swift action after an investigation, with the caveat that everybody is innocent till proven guilty, and we conduct those investigations very seriously, and we take the outcomes of those very seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciated the opening comments. I actually didn't connect the dots until Rep. Snyder asked these questions, but helpful to hear the answers to the questions she posed. I've been very troubled with how the governor's office handled or failed to handle the issues with AG Clarkson, and I'm wondering if your assessment of the response to AG Clarkson, which was known internally, is consistent with the zero tolerance policy you outlined in your opening statement.
Thank you. Through the chair, what I know of that investigation, which is very little, is that investigation was done by the Human Resources Department, that they went through all the evidence before them and made the ultimate decision to put him on unpaid administrative leave until they figured out what else to do. And so I think ultimately the right thing happened there. And I know Kevin very well, and he's a good friend of mine. And I know him to be an honorable man. And he himself would be the first to tell you that he is extremely embarrassed by what had occurred and what had happened, and that it was inappropriate in the workplace. Does that answer your question?
Follow up.
In part, I mean, I'm troubled because I wouldn't describe AG Clarkson's behavior as at all honorable or respectful to his subordinate. Nor would it seem that the governor's office's response to complaints presented to them were decisive. So I guess I'm just looking for a more sort of summative evaluation of how, if you think the way all that unfolded was appropriate, if there's room for improvement or could have been done differently or better.
Representative, through the chair, I'm a firm believer that people should be held accountable. I'm also a firm believer that good people sometimes do bad things, and that doesn't mean we don't hold them accountable. We should, and that's the right thing to do, right? As a society, we need to do that. I guess that's my closing comments on that issue.
Hello?
A different question, if I may, Mr.
Absolutely.
Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Christ Tompkins.
More broadly on the issue of sex crimes and per the chart that you shared with the committee, I think there's 100% consensus that this is a huge issue we need to address in Alaska. If confirmed as Attorney General, do you have a sense of how you want to tackle it and how that might differ from predecessors or previous state policy that, well, based on the current data, maybe hasn't been as successful as we all would like? What's your strategy going
forward? So, through the chair, Representative, it was sort of funny after I received that call from the governor and I accepted the position of Attorney General. I almost was immediately given a binder from my office with all the things that I needed to learn for hearings like this one. And those first 5 days or so, it was very hard to focus on that because I had the ideas that I wanted to put on paper. So I've been taking notes furiously since that time. I've began a search of what is available in the state, whether it's through state government, whether it's through local government, nonprofits. What is out there, specifically what is out there to support victims and families of, I should be careful with that term victim, because the folks that I know that have had those horrible things happen in their lives, they prefer to be referred to as survivors. But what can we do to better support those survivors? Because I think one of the main problems we have is that sometimes these survivors feel like they can't come forward, or if they do come forward, will they be supported? Will they be believed? Will they be mocked? They worry. They worry about those things, and so I want to make sure that they're aware that, from my perspective and from the perspective of the Department of Law, that we're not going to do those things. They will be supported. They will be heard, and we'll take those investigations very seriously.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
And that'll thank you, Mr. Chair. That'll you know, make sense thematically. In terms of concrete policy, and I'm not per se expecting an answer because, you know, you're just stepping into this role, but I'm just curious if there's anything specific that's differentiated from present day or the last year in terms of how you see leading DOL to that policy-wise and substantively would try to tackle this problem.
Representative, through the chair, I don't have those final plans. I'm still sort of in the gathering phase of finding information, talking to survivors, talking to some of those groups that work in this field, in this area, and have a wealth of knowledge that, you know, I'm just stepping into. I ultimately would love to see sort of a summit where we bring these individuals in, we discuss these problems, we come to some action items to take within the state. I haven't formalized plans for that, but I'm certainly would entertain any ideas that you or any other member of this committee have on that subject.
Just a follow-up before, others may have questions, but just in the topic of sexual abuse and sexual assault, the most recent statistics that Mr. Skidmore have provided us shows that about 50% of sex crimes are being declined for prosecution. I mean, that's 620-something cases in the year that was studied, and just about half of those were declined for prosecution. And so when you talk specifically about victims that are unwilling to come forward, it's my general sense that if you go to the villages, it's worse. And so how can somebody come forward if they reasonably, it's highly likely that case will never be prosecuted, and that builds the culture of not coming forward. And I see this as one of the critical steps. And I mean, do you have any thoughts on how to improve that? Because I certainly recognize you shouldn't be bringing cases that you're not going to be able to have a decent odds of winning if the case is weak. But if we're turning down that many, this is a terrible culture to be in. Any thoughts on how to improve that?
Yes, Chairman. You know, I think those are very sobering statistics. And then you go into the statistics where, you know, 70% that only 70% of those that we try result in convictions. And so I think one of the aspects of that is, in my mind, and again, I'm just now sort of becoming proficient in this area of law, but I think a lot of it goes to training the prosecutors, providing that opportunity for our law enforcement. I mean, these cases are very difficult to prosecute, primarily because the actual sex act that creates one of the elements of the case is normally consensual. And as consensual is not a violation of the law. And these acts typically occur in private. That makes it another very and so taking it in a lot of these cases, like, for example, I receive lots of comments about how the testing of all the rape kits resulted in a very few convictions.
It was one.
One. And the reason behind that is most of the time, the fact that the act occurred is not in dispute between the victim and the perpetrator, or the alleged perpetrator. And so that element is just not part of the case. The element that is part of the case is that nuance between what's consensual and what's not consensual. And so that's the part that makes those particularly hard to prosecute. Now, certainly we can do things. We can take measures. We can provide better training, better support for our attorneys. We're making a large step in asking for 10 additional prosecutors and 9 additional support staff. I think that'll go a long ways in reducing the caseload of those that are primarily engaged in prosecution of sex crimes. Right now we have about 67 caseload, just at 30. If they just had 30 a year and you added in the number of average hours it takes to prosecute a sex crime, they're already working well over 40 at 30 cases. Right now they're at 67. So we're hoping with those 10 additional prosecutors we'll bring that number down closer to 40, a little over 40. And we think that that will enable our prosecutors to stay on top of each individual case better. They'll be able to realize that maybe they haven't received feedback from the troopers that they asked for. They can get these things through faster, and I think that'll be also help on the victim side as well, where they feel like we're actually moving the case forward faster, that we're on top of things, that we're keeping them apprised of what's going on and what to expect. And I think all of those elements can help in that address the concern that, oh, if I bring this up, nothing's really going to happen.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, we had a presentation, I believe, from your department earlier in the last couple of weeks, and I remember one of the things that was stated there was a conviction rate of between 70% to 80%, and that stood out to me. One of the reasons it stood out is because I had a conversation some time ago with one of the former municipality prosecutors in Anchorage, and his sage advice to me was that if, as a prosecutor, you have a conviction rate of higher than 70%, you're not doing your job because you're not taking the hard cases that you need to be taking. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. Representative, through the chair, you know, that's an interesting perspective, a perspective I haven't heard yet. And so it'll be interesting as we look, and I intend to look, and I'm sure we have it in the Department of Law, but looking at sort of national statistics, where we are for our rate of successful prosecutions, and as we gather that information and look at that information, maybe we do make that adjustment where we lower the threshold for which we're willing to start a prosecution in those instances. I can't tell you for certainty that that's going to be the outcome, but that's certainly something that we're going to look at.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, what are your thoughts on how the state can reduce the rates of reoffense and recidivism among offenders?
Representative, through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question. And so I really can't provide any thoughts at this time on that. Yeah.
Representative Snyder, did you have your hand up?
I did.
Please go ahead.
It's a bit of a change in topic. I'm happy to wait my turn if there are continued thoughts.
We don't have to be perfectly
honest. Okay, great. Thank you. Through the chair, we've seen a lot of online coverage of it, and I've been getting emails about it, and I wanted to give you the opportunity to provide an answer on this front, and I'm talking about Ben Stevens, Governor Dunleavy's former chief of staff, who was recently, I think we all know at this point, was hired at ConocoPhillips to serve as the vice president of external affairs and transportation. And according to AS 39.52.180, restrictions on employment after leaving state service, Part C, which I can read if that would be helpful to folks. I do have it here. But the short of it being that if a position is not adverse to the public interest, then we would anticipate seeing a written waiver. But to my knowledge, that's not happened or been signed off on. Could you speak to that, why that might be?
Representative, through the chair. That is an issue that we looked at very closely. We didn't have a lot of leadway time on this issue, but we did look at it very closely and ultimately determined that with the general job duties as described and in our talking with Ben Stevens and with the governor's office, that there was no need for a conflict waiver at this time because there was no conflict. And that we decided as a course of action, and that the statement that we released with the Department of Law kind of ended with this part of it, that in the event that one does arise, we'll address it at that time. And I think what you'll probably see over the course of the next couple years within that two-year period is you'll probably see a series of these conflict waivers either being addressed or put into effect to allow Ben Stevens to work in his job duties if it is a benefit to the state. And so I my guess is we're going to see some in the near future.
Okay. Yeah. If I may do a
follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
And for my own education and maybe for some of my colleagues, so I'm trying to understand if it's a kind of a change in policy or approach there with, and I'm probably not going to say this name correctly, but with Bruce Tangeman, who resigned as revenue commissioner in 2019, before becoming a consultant to North Slope Borough, there was a written waiver. Similar with Ed Fogles after leaving Deputy Commissioner of Natural Resources to work as a Pebble Mine consultant, a waiver. And I guess another example is with Daniel Smith, assistant project manager with ADA, leaving to join ANTHC, and again a waiver. Could you clarify how, in y'all's assessment of that, what the main differences were?
Yeah, I can't really comment on those other ones because I didn't participate in those waivers, but I can comment on sort of what my thinking is on those waivers. Anytime that we have an individual that works in state service that works substantially or materially on any given issue and then does that in the private sector within that two-year period is going to need a waiver or they're not able to do that. And so in our assessment with Ben Stevens, there was no obvious immediate reasons to institute a conflict waiver, and in my so you can sort of see how I frame this in my mind. If there is even a question on whether a waiver is needed, my advice to the governor will be institute the waiver, and that's what my advice will continue to be with the governor. And of course, we're both part of that. We both sign off on that waiver. But at this point, like I said, we still haven't had a situation arise where a waiver was necessary because of the activities that Ben Stevens is currently doing. And like I said, I fully predict that we'll see that instance arise. But what we don't want to do as a state is just give a general waiver to everything that Ben Stevens was involved with as a state, because we need to go through that criteria, right? We need to make sure that it is in the state's best interest, given the information that Ben Stevens was privy to, given the circumstances in which he works substantively material on specific issues, whether that really is in the state issue or state's best interest to grant that waiver. Otherwise, if it's not, we're not going to grant the waiver, and Ben Stevens will be prohibited from working on those issues in his current employment for the next 2 years.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
What's the process to ensure that, should a waiver, in your opinion, become necessary, how do you keep tabs on that?
The duty lies with Ben Stevens. So Ben Stevens knows what the duty is, knows what his responsibilities are under the law as it relates to these waivers. And so if he encounters a question in his mind, he knows that he can contact the Department of Law anytime within the next 2 years and speak with our ethics attorneys on whether or not a waiver is needed in that specific situation. And so if he fails to do that, then again, he's subject to the Ethics Act. He's subject to the penalties under that act for his actions. But that responsibility lies with Ben Stevens, and he knows, and he's aware of how that act works and what issues would rise to that level.
Let me just ask a follow-up question, and Representative may have more. So Mr. Stevens is working today, presumably in his office at ConocoPhillips, and let's say there's legislation before us involving oil taxes, a matter of concern to ConocoPhillips. Is it your perspective in that setting that if Mr. Stevens wanted to call and lobby the legislature or the lobby the governor's office on behalf of ConocoPhillips' perspective, he'd need to get a waiver before he did that?
Well, again, the criteria is that materiality of what his involvement was at the governor's office. If it's anything like the materiality of the things that I did as a deputy attorney, as I passed things forward to the attorney general, some of those issues I just tangentially passed through, right? Others I worked on materially. I engaged with the attorney that wrote the opinion or wrote the memo, and I marked it up. I talked with stakeholders. I talked with clients. And so those are the types of things that after my employment with state that I would need a waiver for. But the things that simply came to my desk and I said, yeah, I think that looks pretty good. Why don't you go to the Attorney General for approval? That's not the type of material involvement that the Act anticipates would result in a need for a conflict waiver.
I'm not sure whether my question made it better or worse.
No, I'm just trying to think the through the precedent that sets, because we're not just talking about Ben Stevens, of course. Mm-hmm. You'd be talking about anyone exiting, working in state government, and then now we're they're out in the wild, and then now we're relying on them to come back. Do you think that this approach is the general approach that you would adopt as AG, or is are there additional details or mitigating?
Representative, through the chair, I think this is the right course of action. We want to attract the best people we can possibly get to state government, and we can only do that if they have an ability to work after they're done working for state government. And so that is exactly what the Act anticipates, and the Act is clear in its language that only under certain circumstances would there be a need arise for a conflict waiver. And then it also makes clear that the governor and the AG take a look at that issue, and it's to their discretion whether to grant such a waiver, and that discretion is left to what they feel is in the best for the best state interest. And so I think that is the appropriate. I don't think issuing a broad conflict waiver does anything for the state. It doesn't protect the state at all in certain aspects that might be confidential. Might be there's information that he was privy to that down the road is going to really come in handy for his client, right? That just doesn't make sense for the state to engage in just granting conflict waivers because people are asking for it. We look at each individual circumstance. We examine it against what the requirements of the Act are, and then we make that discretionary decision of whether or not one is needed in that case.
Thank you.
So just a little further follow-up, and then I'll get to Representative Eastman, who's next in the queue. I guess one of the wares that I find a little bit troubling is the notion that you're relying on Mr. Stevens to know what he should or shouldn't do. I mean, I like the notion that he does, but I don't know it. He's not in front of us today. The person in front of us today is you. And so I can imagine a circumstance in which you remembered having a member that you passed from Party A to the Attorney General had no involvement in it, but now you're not working for the state and your memory is you just passed it through. But isn't it really not what Mr. Stevens thinks, but what the state thinks Mr. Stevens' involvement was in making a decision like that? So if he shows up at your doorstep wanting to lobby on an oil tax, isn't it really incumbent on the state to decide, was he involved in the discussions that he shouldn't be showing up in front of us now?
Yeah.
And not really a question for what Mr. Stevens thinks is right or wrong?
Chair, that's a great question, and I'm glad you elaborate on it, because that's exactly right. There are circumstances where the state has knowledge of his material involvement in things, and so certainly we'd step in, and he might get, you know, a letter from the Department of Law saying, hey, cease and desist. You know, under the law, you can apply for a conflict waiver on here, but until then, until it's granted, we need you to stop in your actions. What I'm saying is that the Ethics Act doesn't put liability on the state. The Ethics Act doesn't put liability on departments. The Ethics Act talks about individual responsibility, and that's what I meant by that comment. Thank you for allowing me to clarify that.
Sure, that's fine. So would it be fair to say that your perspective is, rather than giving Mr. Stevens a blanket waiver, you actually want to take it on a case-by-case basis?
That's exactly right. I think that better protects the state. Instead of just granting a blanket waiver and away he goes, and I just think that's a dangerous position for the state to be in, given the confidential nature of the things that probably he was involved in.
And seems like it's likely as the chief of staff he was more involved in more decisions on a confidential level than the average person in the Dunleavy administration.
Yeah, I think that's probably safe to say, but at the same time, that position might not necessarily be materially involved. Like, as a day-to-day basis, he's dealing with 1,000 things, and a lot of those things he doesn't have a material understanding or a working basis or involvement in. And so, you know, I sort of couch it in my own terms of what my own mind understands, and that's my, when I was deputy, what kind of things was I involved in? How substantial was my touches to that issue? And therefore, would I need a waiver after I leave state service?
It doesn't require a response, but I'll just make an observation. The example I had was oil taxes. It's my perception as a member of the legislature for the last 2+ years that Governor Dunleavy pretty much opposed all new oil taxes. So there may not have been any analysis whatsoever that Mr. Stevens had any knowledge of in terms of the governor's position on oil taxes. So there may be nothing particularly problematic about him appearing on that, depending upon what was or wasn't discussed, and I don't necessarily know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, setting aside the specific individual in question, I'm curious, as Attorney General, is there any circumstance in which a former state employee, a former chief of staff, for example, would apply for a waiver and you would deny that waiver? And if so, could you give us an example of what that might look like?
Representative, through the chair, that's a great question. I think the answer to that question is absolutely. There's circumstances that could arise where it's not in the state interest for you to grant that waiver. I could think of a circumstance where they have confidential information about the viability of a state project, right? And say that state project is in a position where there's maybe they're thinking about selling that state project or getting rid of that state project to a private individual or a private entity. In that case, if the individual involved in that purchase had that information, you could see how it would not be in the state interest necessarily for us to grant that waiver, because he or she is privy to that confidential information about the viability, the money that the state spent to see if that project was viable and at what cost and what was necessary. And so there would be a definite conflict there. And then again, we'd have to review that, whether or not that was in the state's interest. But that sort of one circumstance that I can think of that it might be result in a no.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I had some other questions. I don't see anybody else in the queue right now. I want to talk a little bit about power cost equalization. And the topic is whether those funds are sweepable into the general fund. I know that former Attorney General Richards, I had taken the position of the Department of Law that PCE funds and pension funds were not subject to sweep, and that would be changing a court doctrine. Do you have an opinion on that topic?
Through the chair.
That's okay.
You know, that is an issue that we are currently taking a serious look at, and I don't think I've formed an opinion. I know enough about the issue to tell you that there's good arguments on both sides on that issue, whether or not it's sweepable or whether or not it should not be swept. And so that is going to be something that we evaluate, and we ultimately make a decision on if necessary, on what side the Department of Law comes down on that issue.
What's your understanding about whether the court has taken a position about the sweepability of the PCE endowment?
I'm not sure that the court has addressed that directly. There is some court decisions regarding the permanent fund, specifically the earnings reserve fund, that gives some indication on how a court might rule in regards to the power cost equalization fund. But that's as far as we've gotten.
And is it possible that you're under your leadership, the department take a different position on sweepability than past attorney generals have taken?
Chair, that is a distinct possibility. Yeah. There's many things that can happen between now and the last time that an IG had opined on an issue, and some of that is maybe there's some recent court action that would indicate otherwise. Various things could happen between when that decision was made and when a new or different decision is made in the future. So, yeah.
So speaking of court actions, there have been a series of cases. I'll just list a few of them. The case brought by the ASAU about abortion rulings, brought by the ACLU about exempt employee loyalty pledges, brought by ASCA regarding the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, brought by Ashner regarding Medicaid spending, brought by the legislature about forward funding of education, K-12 education, Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association regarding the Pebble Mine and positions the administration has taken on that, same-sex military spouses and right to the permanent fund dividend, the Co-Alaska case regarding Alaska Hire, single subject rule regarding from Alaskans for Better Education, case involving the Pioneer Homes. There's been a long series of cases, and there's really no other way to describe them that the department has been losing almost every single one. And that, to me, as a lawyer, strikes one of two things. Either the governor's getting bad advice, or the governor's getting advice that these cases are unlikely to succeed and the governor's going forward with them anyway, both of which strike me as fairly poor decisions on the governor's part. But I'm never, and I know you're not going to talk about the advice he's getting, but I'm just troubled that this number of cases is going forward and losing on things that they seem like political positions, but legally they're very, very poor positions to take. And I guess my fairly direct question is, how do you expect to change that? Because if you were to ask me what is the single most important job if you're to succeed as Attorney General, it's to convince this governor to stop taking poor cases.
Chair, I'll address that on two different levels. Obviously, as we vet those issues into the future, we're going to take a very close look at probable outcomes based upon recent history and court makeup and everything else that any good attorney should take into account. And I do take sort of not offense. I don't take offense, but I just sort of take. I'm going to argue with some of your words there. Governor.
That's fair.
The governor doesn't make those decisions, at least in my opinion. The Supreme Court and the Constitution make clear that, and the Supreme Court has said many times that the Attorney General is the one that has the discretion to decide what litigation is in the public interest, and I take that responsibility very seriously, and I don't advocate that to anyone else. And so I'm going to be hands-on on those decisions, and certainly we're going to take into account. We have many clients in the Department of Law. You know, we represent every state agency, commission, board, governor's office, you name it, in the executive department, and we have those as clients. So obviously you take into what their interests into account, and then you take a look at seriously at what the law is and what the probable outcomes on. But I am hopeful that under my leadership that we're not going to see a string of losing cases like that.
Can I make a comment?
Representative Christ-Tompkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that question. It kind of boggled my mind when you went through the list, because over the last couple of years, it's like, oh God, another lawsuit. But that's quite a litany. I'm kind of tired of our branch suing your branch also. I would love if we could put a stop to that, and would rather our branch stop winning too. I mean, not to make it direct, but it's like I think it's been an unprecedented period of time, the last couple of years, of interbranch conflict. And I, for what it's worth, I think on an optimistic note, in the last 6 to 12 months, I've sensed that receding to some extent. The first 2 years, just unbelievable. And I think the court outcomes really sort of speak to perhaps the misguidedness of some of the positions the executive was taking. So I just, you know, and this, it's not free either. And I think I have a huge amount of respect for the Department of Law, and I'm really glad that there's an internal ascension happening in the Department of Law with your appointment, and we talked about that. But I think for the first time, given the last couple of years, I was starting to sort of think to myself, gosh, does it start to make sense to ration DOL's budget because they're just going like the charge of the light brigade into these hopeless losing legal battles. So I appreciate your comments. I just want to underscore, I think, the direction Chair Klayman was going.
Chair, can I address those comments a little bit? I didn't mean in any way to denigrate in any manner the good work that the attorneys at the Department of Law do on a day-in and day-out basis. And I'll also make a comment that the list is long, and it's unfortunate. I don't think our involvement as a state in any of those has been unethical in any way. I think there was good legal arguments that supported those stances in all of that litigation. Now, would I have advised that litigation? That's a completely different matter. I also want to address, that the comment that you made about how there's been a lot of litigation between the legislative branch and the executive branch lately, and that's an unfortunate thing. Obviously, with the way that we have three branches of government and the checks and balances, there's going to be some of that tension, right? That's inherent in the system. That's the part of the system that makes the system work so well for the people. But I do want you to know that I'm going to take every opportunity to reach across with legislative legal on these issues, and see if we can't come to an agreement on at least the major issues, right? And work across the aisle as best as I can on those types of issues. And I mean across the aisle, meaning the executive and the legislative branch. That is a promise that I'll make to you to think, talk before file, and hopefully we can resolve some of these issues outside of a courtroom.
So, Representative Drummond, I know, has a question. Just a quick query. I'm just looking because we tried to stop at 3. We had another bill we were trying to hear today to get through public hearing, and I'm just thinking about the questions. I have some more questions, and I saw Representative Eastman has more questions. Representative Vance might have. All of us may have more questions. I'm pondering, can you come back on Wednesday, and can we continue on Wednesday? How does that work on your schedule, or can we go off record for a minute if you want to talk about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that.
Let's go off record briefly. At ease. Back on record. During the break, we were just talking about, got a few ideas of follow-up questions from members, and also checked with the Attorney General's schedule, and it's very apparent to me as Chair that we won't finish in 15 minutes today, so I think we're going to continue your confirmation hearing to a future meeting of this committee. I appreciate the candor of your answers, and I think I really very much appreciate that, because I think we've had some good questions, and I think there'll be more questions, and it's appropriate to give it the time it deserves. So what we're going to do is we're going to continue this confirmation hearing to a future date, and we'll keep the members advised of when that's going to be, as well as the public advised, because I see a couple of reporters here, so I know there's public interest in when this continues. And so we'll let folks know, and we'll coordinate with your office to agree on a mutually convenient time to continue the hearing. and we'll then move on to our second order of business today. I will, for simplicity's sake, no one else has called in to provide public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony. And when we get back, it'll only be the Attorney General and members of the committee with questions. And we will then turn to our second order of business today. But thank you very much for coming. I appreciate your tolerance for starting a little late and not getting all the way through your confirmation hearing. But I
appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for coming.
Our second and final order of business today is House Bill 3, Definition of Disaster Cybersecurity, sponsored by Representative Johnson. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Last week, we left off with questions about the bill. And but before we go to questions about the bill, I want to open public testimony on House Bill 3 to get us through public testimony. Let me turn to House Bill 3. Looks like we have no one online for public testimony. We have available Peter House, who was testifying at the last hearing, Mike Brunig and Niels Andreasen, as well as Eric Cordero Georgiana, who's assisting with the bill for Rep. Johnson's office, but there's no one else looking to testify and no one else in the room, so I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 3. And that will bring us back to questions from the committee about House Bill 3. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. I'm remembering back to, I guess, about where we left off in our last meeting. And I'm just wanting to make sure I understand in my own mind the intent of the sponsor on the bill as regards the accidental versus intentional, I guess, was one of the things we were talking about. I know we've made the switch in the bill from natural disasters to man-made. I know the attorneys gave us the memo on that important distinction. So we're clearly in the man-made realm now. But is the intent of the sponsor to draw a distinction between accidents versus the kinds of attacks and intentionality that we were talking about? I'm a little fuzzy on that, so I'm looking for more clarity.
Mr. Cordero, if you'd like to come forward, and hopefully you can answer Representative Eastman's question.
Thank you. For the record, Eric Cordero, staff to Representative Mike Prox, helping Representative Johnson with this bill. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, certainly the goal is to cover all aspects that are possible to make sure that we are prepared for cybersecurity attacks or vulnerabilities. Vulnerabilities could be unintentional versus an attack that could be, of course, it is, of course, intentional. And so, yes, yeah, certainly that is the intent, is to cover all of that.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, this is a bit astray. Did you say your staff to Representative Prox?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, yes, I am a new staff for Representative Prox, but I'm allowed to help today, Representative Johnson, for the bill, because I was helping her carry that bill.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
For purposes of, I think there was a staff in Representative Prox's office and staff in Representative Johnson's office, and they switched offices because one had more experience in finance and the other had less experience in finance. And to make it more confusing, if you go in Rep. Johnson's office, you'll still find Mr. Cordero in Rep. Johnson's office, and if you go in Representative Prox's office, you'll find the other staffer still sitting in Rep. Prox's office. So if you think this is a little bit, sometimes sounds like who's on first, you would be correct. Representative Eastman.
Thank you for the
hopefully clarity. Not with regard to staffing.
Thanks for the clarity on that last issue. I think that's an important issue for us to think about as a committee. The other question that I had, and I'm trying to remember where we left off on, was the difference between, you know, any type of cyber attack or cyber intrusion, and, you know, wanting to capture that, versus, I think the language in the bill currently is cybersecurity. So there has to be that added bar, which deals with, there has to be basically someone manning the gates or some type of security that's been breached, as opposed to just a breach itself. And what was the intention on that distinction? To cover both equally, or to focus just on the cybersecurity aspect of it. I think that's the way it's currently drafted.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, let me see if I understand this. Are you trying to see if the intent was to cover both cybersecurity attacks and have some sort of plan? I mean, I don't know. May you please?
Yeah, so it just helps with the language in the bill. And we heard testimony that there's a distinction between a cyber attack and a cybersecurity attack, or some type of cyber disaster and the cybersecurity disaster. And the latter, you know, has to have a more strict criteria. There has to be some type of defense that's been breached, whereas, you know, maybe a normal cyber attack could just be an unmanned gate and somebody walks through the door. And I'm just wondering, is there an intention to cover both or just to cover the cybersecurity aspect of it?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, the sponsor's intention is to cover all of it.
Thank you.
All right, I don't see any other.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I had a question the other day about what are considered political subdivisions of the state. On that day, Mr. Wyatt, the IT director of the Mat-Su Borough, testified about their cyber attack in 2019. Will the state be assisting boroughs to protect themselves should this bill, should this definition of disaster be amended by this bill?
Through their chair, Representative Drummond, thank you for the question. It will depend on the circumstances of the potential disaster. Each borough or city or municipality, they can declare their own disaster if something occurs. And then it depends on whether or not it is contained or not contained, in which they may seek assistance from the state. And at a meeting with the State Affairs Committee, somebody from the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs gave an explanation of how that usually works. The difference is that the Mat-Su Borough, when they had this attack, they try to get additional assistance from the state by having the state declare a disaster. And because this was not clarified in statute, that didn't happen. They still received assistance, but it just wasn't as quick or as it wasn't as easy to get as if this had been in statute.
Okay.
Chair, Representative, regarding your questions on, I believe Mr. Andreasen answered most of those questions, but there was one entity that you mentioned that we didn't mention at the last meeting, which is the Alaska Railroad. The Alaska Railroad is an instrumentality of the state and therefore would be covered under this statute.
Yeah, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. My staff just handed me an email that I was unaware of that does list as political subdivisions of the state municipalities, school districts, REAAs, public and quasi-public corporations such as Alaska Housing Finance Corporation of the Alaska Railroad, as well as the University of Alaska, and I believe those were my questions. So this appears to be defined in law, so I'm comfortable with that part of it. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee.
Yep.
Got to get quick, Representative Eastman. I looked straight at you, and your hand wasn't up. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was still ruminating on the comments of our previous committee member. And
I always give you a lot of time to ruminate here.
Thank you. Through the chair. You know, and maybe there's not an easy answer to this, but the question that I'm left with, maybe you have an answer to, is with as broad as we're making the language on this topic, and I could list off all the different ways we've broadened it, but I won't. Is there a good reason not to allow the governor to declare something a disaster if there's the potential for, you know, federal aid and that sorts of things? Should we limit that discretion, or should we just give him the ability to, you know, if he feels like it should be a disaster, then give him that opportunity without limiting it the way the statute currently does?
Through their chair, Representative Bisman, I'm not going to be able to answer that question. That's a policy call. But in regards to the proposal before you, there are certain things that have to be met in order to declare a disaster. And so whether or not the governor should have or not have the authority to declare more disasters or less disasters, that's truly a policy call that is not being addressed by this bill.
Thank you.
All right. Now, hearing and seeing no other questions, we're going to adjourn for the day. We will hold this bill, House Bill 3, for further review. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 17 at 1:30 p.m. If anyone is considering an amendment to House Bill 3, please let our office know and submit them electronically by noon on Wednesday, March 17. It is also my intention to take up any such amendments to House Bill 3 during our meeting on Wednesday and then pass the bill on a committee following final questions and discussion. So please plan to attend Wednesday's meeting in person to sign the paperwork. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:58 p.m.